underscores the isolation of the Zionist regime. He also thanked the Islamic Republic of Iran for its steadfast support for the Palestinian cause and nation.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, thanking Allah the Almighty in the holy month of Ramadan as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Ramadan Kareem, Ramadan Mubarak. What a beautiful month to be living in the holy month of Ramadan. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it has trials and hardships, but a beautiful month indeed. And what blessings are in this holy month of Ramadan. Many of us, probably all of us, can never fully fathom the great blessings that are within this month. Of course, we are being purified second by second by the grace and the will of the Almighty Allah. So we're talking about shukr, we're talking about thanking Allah, we're talking about being grateful to Allah, we are talking about appreciating the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, you know, being grateful to Allah is a very fundamental thing, but despite being a very fundamental thing, many times we really don't pay too much attention to it. And matter of fact, the more we become engrossed in materialism and in this world and, you know, in this rat race and this hamster wheel that we have become stuck in, we tend to forget not only the afterlife, but we tend to forget simple things such as asking for forgiveness for our errors and our mistakes, and likewise thanking Allah for all the blessings that we have in our lives. I mean, truly, do we ever sit down and think about all the things and all the blessings that Allah has given us, has provided us, has endowed us with? Most probably we don't think twice about that. We don't think twice about the food that Allah has provided us during the suhoor, the pre-dawn fasting meal, right, that we have before we start our fasting. Or, for example, an iftar, you know, after our fasting, when we break our fast, do we ever thank Allah for the food that He has provided? And the list goes on and on to the various blessings that we have that we don't bother to thank Allah for.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, holy month of Ramadan, and we are talking about thanking Allah. Now, one way that you can thank Allah is by saying shukran lillah, you know, thanks be to Allah. Or you can say alhamdulillah, praise be to Allah. Or even in your own language, you can say, oh Allah, I thank you for all the countless and numerous bounties and blessings that you have given me, right? These are different verbal forms in which we can thank the Almighty Allah. But of course, you know, the deeper it comes from our heart and the more sincere this gratefulness and this appreciation to the Almighty Allah is, the more impact it has on ourselves and our relationship with the Almighty Allah. Of course, that is another part of our Islamic lifestyle. And in the holy month of Ramadan, this is something that is easier to do, and that is to establish a connection and a relationship with the Almighty Allah. And what better way than to praise Allah? What better way than to be grateful to Allah, to appreciate the things that Allah has given you? So since we're running out of time on the program, one last point is that we should actively think about the things that Allah has given us to, you know, the extent possible. Because when you start to count the things that Allah has given you, you will very quickly realize that there are so many things that you really won't be able to count all of them. Things as simple as, you know, having the health to be able to breathe or eat, or the blessing of family, or the blessing of the holy month of Ramadan, or the blessing of being a Muslim. When you start counting them, you will realize that there are many countless blessings. And you thank Allah for each one of these blessings. And every time you can bring up different blessings, you know, and you can speak with Allah, saying to Him that you have given me a certain bounty and a certain blessing, and I appreciate that, and I thank you for that, and you are so compassionate and merciful and kind and generous that you have provided these things without wanting anything in return. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I so alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ramadan in the UK.
Part 1.
Ramadan, the month when Muslims refrain from food, drink, and marital relations during daylight hours, is a special time for Britain's 3 million Muslims. Physical and spiritual rewards are worth it.
Ramadan has been a fantastic time in the sense that it's about spiritually connecting with the law of the heavens and the earth and detoxing your bodies.
Ramadan is the month of prayer in the Quran, when Muslims do their best to cultivate willpower, discipline, and self-restraint. They also increase their charitable activities and empathize with the poor, needy, and destitute.
We feed people, we sit together and we share food with everyone, and this is part of it. Because they don't have it, we bring the food to them. They can't come to us, so we bring it to them. And that's the whole thing about Ramadan, which is, you know, you share and you care.
But Ramadan isn't just about self-sacrifice. It's about sharing food with your family and friends. It's about increasing solidarity with your Muslim brothers and sisters at home and abroad. And it's about showcasing the beauty of Islam to the non-Muslim majority living in the UK.
Certain headlines are putting the lives of many innocent people at risk. So what can we do?
With Islam and Muslims regularly demonized in the British media, Ramadan is a golden opportunity for Muslims to showcase the true Islam and I've been traveling around the country during the holy month in search of exactly that. Like many Muslims in majority non-Muslim countries, British Muslims can sometimes be the subject of unwelcome scrutiny. Sometimes being a Muslim in Britain can feel a bit like being under siege. So the month of Ramadan, when Muslims fast from dawn to dusk, can come as a welcome relief for many, a time for physical and spiritual renewal, as well as an opportunity to improve relations between Muslims and non-Muslims alike. The Hussein family, who live in North London, are getting ready to break their fast. Like British Muslims all over the country, the Husseins have spent the last month fasting, so the evening meal will come as a relief. Mrs. Hussein is also preparing some food to take round to her non-Muslim neighbours.
Could you encapsulate what Ramadan means for you, Zishan?
For me, it's reconnecting with my Lord. It's like understanding what is the purpose of your life, which is to worship your Lord and to be the best person that you can be.
Someone can ask the same question.
Yeah, for me, it's about reprogramming, deprogramming all the bad habits I've gotten into, kind of reprogramming what's required of me from my Lord, and self-discipline.
Fasting is compulsory on every Muslim who is sane and mature, male or female. It has many physical, moral, and social benefits. But most importantly, God has made fasting compulsory so that Muslims become pious, fearing, and God-conscious.
We know that the shaitans are locked up during this month. And for me, that's definitely something that I notice. It becomes a lot more easier to pick up the Quran, spend a little bit more time on the Quran. And you notice like small habits changing. So when you're on the tube, like on my phone, I'll get the Quran out. I'm much more likely to get the Quran out and start to read as I'm sat commuting. And it's like you sort of, because you're sort of waiting for the time when you open your fast, you realise that I can use this time to do things that are better than just wasting time watching TV or Facebook or whatever.
I made Ramadan gift bags for my neighbours, my non-Muslim neighbours, and I distributed them with a little note saying what Ramadan means to us. In terms of my Muslim community, yeah, we've had a lot of Ramadan iftar invites, so we've been going to them.
It's time to break the fast during a meal which is known as iftar. I join my hosts in a lovely and refreshing Asian dinner. Often Muslims will overeat at this time to compensate for what they've been missing out on. But the correct Islamic etiquette is to fill two-thirds of your stomach with food and drink and leave the last third empty. Tonight at least, I think we've stuck to that.
The Quran is a unifying factor for Muslims of all different traditions, sects and cultures. All Muslims believe it's the literal, unchanging word of God, and they strive to live their lives according to its strictures. Now, the recitation of the Quran is considered something of an art form all across the Muslim world.
Ramadan was the month during which the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, and many Muslims will attempt to recite the whole book before the month ends. The very act of fasting is prescribed in the Quran so that, the Holy Book says, believers can learn piety. The rules of fasting are also set out in its pages, with those unable to fast due to illness, travelling and old age exempt. This is because God intends ease for us.
The message of the Holy Quran is to guide the human being. That is the book of guidance. That is the book of guidance to all universe, not just Muslims, because this book is not written by a person. It's the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is from secure source. So it is the book of past, the book of present, and the book of future.
Muslims believe the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad over a period of 23 years. The Holy Book emphasizes the duty of mankind to worship, fear, love, and obey the one God who created the heavens and the earth. the God of Muhammad, Jesus, and Moses. If the Quran's central message is monotheism, it also teaches Muslims how to live a good life, which will ultimately grant them entrance into paradise, and how to avoid the sins which will consign them into hell. During the month of Ramadan, prayer is also a priority for Muslims. Believers are required to pray 5 times a day, even outside of Ramadan. But during the holy month, Muslims will often perform additional prayers, especially in the mosque. Again, the prayer is a combination of movements and gestures, which symbolize submission to God, as well as Quranic recitation, which reminds believers of His holy words.
This is the month of revelation of Quran, so He wants us to attach yourself with Quran, because the rewards are multiplied in the month of Ramadan. He has given the attraction to the people. Okay, if you read, normally you are rewarded 10 times. In this month, you will be rewarded 70 times. People think that being thirsty, if you do not eat and do not drink anything, that is fast. No. There is a fast of your stomach. There is a fast of your eyes. There is a fast of your ears. There is a fast of your tongue. There is a fast of your hands. And there is a fast of your food as well. Like the whole body should be fasting, not just your stomach. If you're hungry and still you're abusing people, Allah says, I have nothing to do with your thirst.
This is the time that we spend more time on ourselves. Because rest of the year, maybe we are very busy with, you know, day-to-day work. But in the months of Ramadan, our physical activities, maybe our, you know, some of our contacts reduce, so that we have more time for our contemplation and, you know, prayer, recitation, and being with the community.
Ramadan is a time for communities to come together. Every night at dusk, the fast is broken, most often with family and friends or in the mosque. It's a great opportunity for people who don't see each other much the rest of the year to get together. And it's also a time when Muslims belonging to different sects unify.
I'm trying to think back, have I been to any Shia mosque? I don't think I have actually ever before. I mean, I know there are some slight variations in prayer, and I know that's the kind of the set, the timings for iftar are a bit different, but that's it. That's the extent of my knowledge actually about Shias. But again, and Shias are a vast, you know, there are many different schools. I actually don't know much about Shias. So yeah, let's see what happens.
Raza Nadim is a Sunni Muslim, which means he belongs to the majority sect of Islam. But tonight he'll be breaking his fast at a Shia mosque, Islam's minority sect. Sunnis and Shias share a belief in the major tenets of Islam, such as God, the Quran, and the Prophet Muhammad, but they may differ on other details of Islamic jurisprudence and history. In general, the two sects have coexisted in relative peace throughout Islamic history, with some exceptions, of course. But with political events in the Middle East currently at boiling point, sectarian tensions can sometimes spill over.
Without having unity, we would be not able to face our challenges. And indeed, we would be just challenging ourselves internally and exhausting ourselves without reaching to any conclusion.
What terrorist groups want to do, they want to create division between the Muslims. They want to create, you know, an us and them situation between the Muslims and also then between the Muslims and the wider community. And if we are really fighting amongst ourselves, then that really, you know, makes them a winner. And we want to make sure that we believe in the same God, we believe in the same Holy Quran, and those who believe in the same, you know, scripture, you know, they are part of the creed of Islam. You know, and the concept of takfir is absolutely cancer in Islam. You know, it's eating us away.
Shia Muslims break their fast a few minutes later than Sunni Muslims do, and they tend to combine the sunset prayer and the night prayer, called Maghrib and Isha in Arabic, unlike Sunnis. But these minor differences between the sects don't seem to bother Raza too much.
is different. I mean, it's a lot of similarities that you see in the way people pray. Some similarities. But yeah, I didn't realize that they combined the Isha as well during Ramadan. I thought that they had a Taraweeh prayer, but I'm guessing that doesn't happen. But yeah, and the food was good. It's better than my local mosque, that's for sure. Right now, you see Muslims being attacked left, right and centre. The last thing you want is to be fighting amongst each other. And I think a lot of it is misunderstanding. So, I mean, you know, earlier they were doing the recitation of the Quran. There was no difference. It's all the same. People sitting there remembering God, you know, glorifying the Prophet. And it's so many similarities. And for me, I mean, I knew that there were many similarities, but to see them in action, that is, you know, it just kind of breaks a mental barrier. And I think especially for a lot of Muslims that are quite hardline sectarian on both sides of the camp, I think they should go to different mosques just because you realise we're not that different. And yeah, we all like our food at iftar time.
The limelight. Near 100 soldiers who served in the British Armed Forces in Iraq may have been exposed to a toxic chemical while posted to guard the Ramat Ali water treatment plant near Basra in 2003. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. Iraqi war veteran Andy Tosh points to his nose where he was treated for skin cancer and shows the red marks on his hand. He says his health has been permanently damaged not by baking heat of the Iraqi desert, but by a toxic chemical at an industrial site he was ordered to guard. The 58-year-old former Royal Air Force RAF sergeant says, "It's clear British troops were knowingly exposed to dangerous chemicals." Sky News can reveal that nearly 100 British troops may have been exposed to sodium dichromate while guarding the Ramat Ali water treatment plant in 2003. 10 British veterans who guarded the plant have now spoken publicly about their ordeal and say they feel betrayed by the British government after struggling with a range of health problems, including daily nosebleeds, a brain tumour, and 3 who have been diagnosed with cancer. Described as a deadly poison, sodium dichromate is a known carcinogen. According to the former British serviceman, the ground at Ramat Ali was covered in it. Britain's Ministry of Defence claims it is willing to meet the veterans to work with them going forward, but the former troops say they want answers and accountability. Lord Richard Dannett, former chief of the British General Staff, called for a proper investigation into what happened. He told Sky News, "And if the health of some of these service people have been affected, then I guess there probably is a case for at least medical support, if not financial compensation." In the opening months of the Iraq War, around 88 British troops were deployed to Ramat Ali, providing an armed guard detail round the clock. Located near Basra in southern Iraq, Ramat Ali was built in the 1970s to pump water through a network of pipes in order to flush out oil nearby. Wearing heavy combat gear, British soldiers endured baking 50 degrees Celsius heat in the day and listened to rocket fire from gunmen at night as they patrolled the industrial facility. What they didn't know was that the place was contaminated with sodium dichromate, a chemical used to prevent corrosion. Before the US took over the site, the water was filtered and treated with sodium dichromate to increase the life of pipelines, pumps, and other equipment. It is a type of hexavalent chromium, a group of compounds made famous by the 2000 film Erin Brockovich, which dramatized the contamination of water around a California town. Members of the military described how thousands of bags of the orange powder were kept in a building with no roof, some of them ripped open, exposing their contents to the wind. Others were spread throughout the facility. Investigation by the U.S. Defense Department found service members and civilians were exposed to toxic chemicals. The report also pointed blame at U.S. contractor KBR for a delay in recognizing and responding to the hazard posed by sodium dichromate. It said KBR became aware of the use of sodium dichromate at Ramat Ali as early as 31st of May 2003. When the company reviewed an Iraqi operating manual describing the use of the chemical at the facility. According to the report, both KBR and Task Force Restore Iraqi Oil, the military group responsible for restoring Iraqi oil production, reported in June of 2003 that the site was potentially contaminated with sodium dichromate, which they recognized as a carcinogen. The plight of U.S. troops who were exposed to sodium dichromate at Ramat Ali is far better documented than their British counterparts. National Guardsmen who visited the site have become ill, leading to a formal inquiry and government support for veterans across the pond. In a high-profile court case, 12 U.S. servicemen were awarded $85 million after a jury found KBR failed to protect them from exposure to cancer-causing chemicals. Each soldier was awarded $7.1 million for reckless and outrageous indifference to their health in the trial in Oregon. However, the case was overturned after KBR argued that Oregon court did not have jurisdiction and it should be transferred to Texas. Ultimately, an appeals court decided in favor of KBR, affirming a previous ruling that the Ramat Ali veterans had not provided sufficient evidence that any health issues were caused by sodium dichromate. The former British servicemen say, "In Britain, there has been no dedicated ongoing support for Ramat Ali veterans and silence from the government. They say they feel let down and worry that they could develop cancer at any time as a result of their exposure two decades ago." The website of Arab News has also covered the same story and tells us more. British veteran Tim Harrison says he has experienced worsening nosebleeds in recent years, which he believes are the result of his exposure to sodium dichromate during the Iraq War. Another Ramat Ali veteran, Craig Warner, was medically discharged from the Royal Air Force after he was found to have a brain tumour, a condition his surgeon attributed to chemical exposure. Other veterans who say they have long-term health problems after being exposed at Iraq's Ramat Ali water treatment plant in 2003 include Eric Page, who has been treated for testicular cancer that had spread to his stomach lymph nodes and severe headaches. Ben Evans, whose nose had to be cauterized to stop nosebleeds. Tony Waters, whose arms itch until they bleed. Andrew Day, who has regular nosebleeds and lesions on his arms, and Darren Waters, who has a rash on his shin. And they say they're not the only ones from their squadron who have become unwell. Two others are reported to have died, although it's not been confirmed if their deaths are related to health problems linked to the Ramat Ali site. Just one of the Ramat Ali veterans to have spoken to the Arab News is without ongoing symptoms, but he said he worries about what could happen in the future. The veterans say some who have served there may still be unaware of the exposure at all. A 2019 analysis of existing studies found that hexavalent chromium, of which sodium dichromate is a type, may cause cancers of the respiratory system, buccal cavity and pharynx, prostate and stomach in humans, and it is related to increased risk of overall mortality owing to lung, larynx, bladder, kidney, bone and thyroid cancer. During the US Senate inquiry, epidemiologist Herman Gibbs said symptoms reported by soldiers during their time at the site were consistent with significant exposure to sodium dichromate. He said it was possible that chromium could cause continuing symptoms after leaving the body, given its highly irritative nature. Now discharged from the military and 2 decades after they were posted to Karmat Ali site, the British veterans say they want the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, to take responsibility. They want a public inquiry into what happened and for the Ministry of Defence to ensure that everyone who served at Karmat Ali has been contacted and offered ongoing medical support.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified, the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be covering the growing popularity of Quds Day and the frantic efforts of Zionist extremists to undermine and sabotage it. Record numbers are expected at this year's rallies because the world has been awoken by the unspeakably horrific atrocities being perpetrated by the Zionist entity in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Atifa Abu Chakra has been looking at the history of Quds Day and the extraordinary efforts by the Zionist lobby to close it down.
Quds Day is celebrated all over the world traditionally on the last Friday of Ramadan. It is a day of international solidarity with the Palestinian people, named with the Arabic word for Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine. Quds Day was introduced in 1979 by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Quds Day was a response to Jerusalem Day, in which Jewish settlers rampage around Al-Quds, which they call Jerusalem, chanting racist slogans including "May your village burn." The Zionist entity heightened attempts to suppress Quds Day after the Gaza massacre between 2008 to 2009. The worldwide revulsion against the massacre led to a significant rise in support for the Palestinians and worldwide protests. Quds Day is marked throughout Muslim and Arabic countries in over 80 Islamic and non-Islamic countries in total. In the West, these include the United States of America, Canada, Australia, Germany, Spain, the United Kingdom, France, and Greece. The Muslim unity displayed in Quds Day is a threat to the Zionist entity and its supporters and assets in the West and elsewhere. Accordingly, they mobilized to smear and denounce Quds Day and to claim that its celebration exhibits extremism and anti-Semitism. In the UK, Zionist groups have been attempting to sabotage the celebration for more than 15 years. In the US, Zionist entity assets have gone on the offensive, The Anti-Defamation League denounced Al-Quds Day in 2016 as a hateful demonstration of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic sentiment. In 2022, it ludicrously labeled calls for the dismantling of Zionism as genocidal ambitions. In Germany, Bundesamt für Verfassungsschutz, or Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution in English, is the domestic intelligence agency. In 2019, it published a deeply racist report on anti-Semitism in Islamist extremism. It specifically singled out Quds Day and denounced a huge range of Muslim political groups as extreme. All were labeled with the Zionist-created notion of Islamic anti-Semitism. The report openly states that German intelligence spies on peaceful and legal Muslim activists, so long as they're defined as Islamist, a racist term which effectively covers any Muslim active in politics. The temporary Zionist entity continues its onslaught of ethnic cleansing and murder in Gaza and throughout the region. Complicit Western governments continue to try and repress pro-Palestine sentiment. But this year, the celebrations of Quds Day go ahead in a situation where support for Palestine is at a historic high as the result of the genocide in Gaza.
Joining me in the studio as usual is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and is now a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyn University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is Nazim Ali, who joins us via Zoom. In his professional life, Nazim is a pharmacist, but he's also a passionate pro-Palestine campaigner. And it was his activism that brought him to the attention of the Zionist lobby. These extremists subjected him to a seven-year-long malicious hate-filled campaign and pressurised the General Pharmaceutical Council to strike him off. Thankfully, the despicable ploy to destroy Nazim's career and deprive him of his livelihood was rejected. Welcome to the show. Nazim, what's been your experience of Quds Day in the United Kingdom?
Hi, Chris. Hi, thanks for having me. It's been very interesting. I went to the first one in 1988. It's a very inclusive protest that occurs every single year, as Latifa said in the prequel there, on the last Friday of every Ramadan. We actually have it mainly on a Sunday in England because it's a weekend. Probably the safest annual rally ever in the history of the United Kingdom, without doubt. I don't know of any arrests. If anything, the arrests happened with the counter-protesters. It's unique, actually. It seems to galvanise the far right, i.e. the BNP, etc., and the Zionists to come and protest against us together. So it's one of the only few processions where you'll get the counter-demonstrators having a Union Jack, having a Zionist flag, far-right stickers all over them, coming together. So it's helped unite these really extreme right-wing groups. But over the years, absolutely peaceful from our side, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, certainly that's been my experience of it. I mean, and I've attended the Quds Day demonstration last year and can certainly endorse everything you've just said there, Nazim. But David, the Zionists, they've been trying to suppress the Quds Day for 15 years, haven't they?
They have. They don't like it. And they don't like it because, of course, it's a militant demonstration and doesn't pull its punches. It says, you know, this is Quds, it's the capital of Palestine. It's not the capital of Israel. And, of course, they've been trying in the UK. Certainly it's the case, in Nazim's case especially. But also in the US, where the Anti-Defamation League have been very active. We've talked about them many times on this show before.
Of course, yeah.
And also in that case in Germany, a truly extraordinary case there, where the German intelligence services were actually smearing and libelling pro-Palestine demonstrators as being somehow effectively Nazis. And this is the kind of the stuff you get from the Zionists, of course. We've seen this on many, many occasions in many episodes of this show. This is what they do. They want to stop any possible expression of support for Palestinian rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nazim, I mean, how does Quds Day then differ, would you say, from other pro-Palestine marches?
I mean, I think its origin, its origin story, I think is really important. Again, as Atifa mentioned, it was initiated by the late Ayatollah Khomeini. And it differs in the sense that it does come from a real political base. It comes from a point of no compromise with the oppressor. It comes from a very anti-colonial standpoint. And it's very strong on that. And it's all about freedom, and it's all about removing the chains of colonialism and oppression, understanding the fact that Palestine is the key. So wherever there's oppression going on in the world, wherever there's colonialism still in its various forms existing, if we can unlock the situation of Palestine, it will unlock every other puzzle that's going on. That's the uniqueness of Kurds Day, and that's why it's so important. And come rain, wind or shine, Chris, in England, it takes place. Doesn't matter if it's because it's in Ramadan, it changes 10 days every year. So we have it when it's snowing, we have it when it's hailstones, thunderstorms. We've never cancelled except in COVID, and then we went online.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, David, I believe you're speaking at this year's Kurds Day demonstration in London, aren't you? I mean, that kind of demonstrates, doesn't it, the sort of serious politics of the organisers, wouldn't you agree?
Well, it does. I mean, since I've won my case at Industrial Tribunal, I've not had a single invitation to speak cancelled, which is unusual before my tribunal judgment was released. Most meetings that I was invited to were cancelled, or indeed sometimes there were attempts by pro-Palestine campaigners to cancel my meetings as well, not just the Zionists, Incredible. But also people from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, its headquarters, have tried to stop me from speaking at PSC branches. But this is an indication, really, that that the organisers of this demonstration are serious, that they're serious about their anti-Zionism and about not compromising with Zionism. Zionism is a form of racism. It's a genocidal ideology. Everybody can see that now, and we should have nothing to do with Zionism. Zionism is something which should be challenged, and we should be moving towards an eradication of Zionism as a racist ideology. And not all of the pro-Palestine movement, I'm afraid to say, would endorse such politics.
No, we do. And we talked in this show, haven't we, about the need really for a de-Zionisation process to basically eradicate this kind of racist ideology from the country and indeed from the world. But Nazim, I mean, what's your assessment of the Palestine Solidarity Movement today? I mean, David just mentioned there that previously when he's had speaking engagements, he's had objections indeed from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. I mean, what's your thoughts about that today?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we know there's always been a history, especially in the UK, of certain organisations infiltrating other organisations and trying to change the narrative. And as David's just alluded to, it's imperative we stick to the anti-Zionist narrative because there's a lot of blowback from it, especially when we are being absolutely determined to take on Zionism. It causes a lot of consternation among certain people and a bit of fear of the blowback and the potential of consequences, whatever they are, that people and organizations feel. And, you know, some organizations don't want, and I mean this respectfully, if I can, don't want to be tarred under the same type of label as other organizations, et cetera, et cetera. A bit of a cop-out, if you ask me. I don't think there's any space to compromise when it comes to Palestine, when it comes to talking about far-right ideologies like Zionism. We've got to be out there, and we've got to put it on a plate and serve it.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, I mean, despite the 15-year-long campaign by the Zionists to try and destroy Kurds Day, I mean, the actual demonstrations getting bigger and bigger every single year. And as I've said in the introduction, I think we're expecting record attendances at the demonstrations this year. What do you think that says?
Well, it says that the movement for Palestinian liberation is on the march, and that it's rising, its support for it is rising across the whole world, including in countries like Western countries where the governments are supporting the Zionist onslaught on Gaza. But the population is becoming more and more radical in support of the Palestinians, and Kurds Day is a kind of cutting edge of that. And we see the increased consciousness that there is in the country and the increasing inability of the Zionists to stop this kind of campaigning. And so we have the situation where we looked at this the other day, just in the show, where the government is trying to step in and to divide the movement by labelling some parts of the Palestine Solidarity Movement as being extremist. Now, of course, this is going to fail, but that's an indication of the threat that they face, that they feel that they face from the Palestine Solidarity Movement.
Mm-hmm. And Nazim, the attendance at the Kurds Day demonstrations is incredibly mixed, isn't it? Very diverse attendees, a big Jewish contingent, for example, I believe. Is that briefly? I mean, that's true, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's a very family-friendly protest. A lot of children come along with their families, with their parents, and we have a large contingent of Jewish people, especially rabbis from the Neutral Kartai movement, as well as other Jews as well who come, anti-Zionist Jews who come to the procession. In fact, it's very multi-faith, and people of no faith attend as well. And even from the speakers list, if you go back historically, is a big variety from the far left to people who are more sort of religious, coming from a religious perspective, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, very, very diverse.
No, indeed. We'll come back in a moment, Nazim, to our discussion after our next report about the truly astonishing lengths that the Zionist lobby went to in their efforts to ruin the career of our guest, Nazim Ali.
The London pharmacist Nazim Ali has finally won his long-running legal battle against Zionist regime proxies. It all started in 2017 when Nazim Ali spoke at the Quds Day rally. Zionists complained about his anti-Zionist comments to the police. The Crown Prosecution Service refused to press charges. The Zionists took a private prosecution that was eventually stopped by the CPS. They took out a judicial review against the CPS and lost. In January 2019, Ali's professional regulator, the General Pharmaceutical Council, said there was no case to answer, but gave him a warning for being offensive. The CAA then bullied the regulator into reversing its position in July of that year. The council concluded his words were not anti-Semitic in November 2020. But the UK Lawyers for Israel joined the campaign against anti-Semitism to continue to harass Ali. In December 2020, UK LFI complained to the body which regulates the regulator, the Professional Standards Authority for Health and Social Care, or PSA. The intimidation worked, and the PSA took the GPC to court, at which point the GPC folded and offered no defence. The High Court then sent the case back to the GPC, which made the absurd determination that two of Ali's remarks were objectively, if unintentionally, anti-Semitic. However, it gave him a warning as before. The Zionists were still not happy and appealed to the court to get Ali sacked. In March this year, the court declared that there was no case to answer. This is a historic and hard-fought victory. But who are the Zionist groups who have bullied and intimidated the professional regulators into such submission? The campaign against anti-Semitism took up the cudgels first. The CAA is a creature of the Zionist regime. It was set up to attack the pro-Palestine movement with fake anti-Semitism allegations. Much of its early funding came from the Jewish National Fund, the racist land theft group, which is one of the four so-called national institutions in Israel. The UK Lawyers for Israel is a group which appears to have been set up under the auspices of the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Its whole purpose is to use lawfare tactics to manipulate the law and bully British institutions into doing its bidding. The case tells us how foreign agents of the Zionist regime can harass, bully, and intimidate so effectively that they can, in effect, occupy the professional bodies regulating the profession of pharmacy. This is what state capture looks like. It also tells us that people can fight back and win. In fact, this is one of a number of recent victories against the Zionist movement. The tide is turning.
Well, congratulations on your historic win, Nazim. I mean, it must have been a great relief to finally resolve this what can only be described as a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. 7 years long. And, every point, every part that we won, they would come back. And the interesting thing is, Chris, a lot of this didn't cost any of these campaigning organizations, the Zionist ones, any money, apart from the judicial review, if I recollect correctly, because they've been pressurizing, the powers that be to take these cases on. In this last one, I think it's important to know that as they lost, they had to pay, the PSA has to pay costs. It had £43,000 of its own costs and £13,000 of the GPHC's costs to pay. So that's all going to come from a government fund. And that is taxpayers' money, £56,000, just to get me struck off, which they failed to do. which makes no sense when the GPHC committee, Fitness and Practice Committee, have been well within their rights to find a determination that they found. And they found me that a warning was ample enough. So questions need to be asked, really. What made the PSA take this back to the High Court at expense of the taxpayers' money?
No, indeed. Well, questions certainly do need to be asked. But, David, what do you make of Nazim's case? I mean, it seems absolutely crazy, doesn't it? That he had to go through, four different processes, numerous different processes, actually, involving separate organisations between the Zionists, the police, the courts and the regulators. I mean, what does that tell us about the nature of the Zionist lobby?
Well, it tells you that they intend to intimidate, bully and harass any organisation that gets in their way, and they intend to be able to occupy those organisations. So as Nazim has been saying, these were organisations which did it off their own bat. The Zionists didn't even have to lift a finger in some cases, because the organisations took each other to court and fought like rats in a sack to more effectively implement the Zionist organisations' wishes. So what we have is not just an occupation of these regulatory bodies. The regulator of pharmacists and the regulator of the regulator of pharmacists, not just occupied, but effectively captured by the State of Israel and doing the bidding of the State of Israel, which is currently engaged in a genocide. This is no way to run any kind of democracy, and it shows the way in which the hostile foreign power, which is Israel, is able to actually get inside regulatory bodies and to turn them against the purposes they're intended to be there for. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of unbelievable vindictiveness, isn't it? It's astonishing. It really is. But Nazim, I mean, how has this long and drawn-out battle affected you personally and, of course, professionally as well?
Quite badly, if I'm honest. You're not used to seeing your face on the centre spread of the Jewish Chronicle front page, being called a preacher of hate. Terms like Islamist being used, and they do it deliberately. So all the way from the right-wing press in the UK to the right-wing press in America and in Israel itself. So if anyone was going to work with me and Google my name, as which people do these days, all this stuff comes up. So it's all planned. It's all done in a very methodical way. The way they release the news, it first comes in the more Zionist press, and then it comes in the mainstream press 2-3 weeks later. It follows a set pattern. And, of course, it affects your mental health. It affects your well-being. It affects your relationships. It affects everything and your place at work. Just to give you a side thing on that, they, funnily enough, where I work, they contacted every non-brown-named person, individual, back in 2017, saying, you work for an anti-Semite, how do you feel about it? But they didn't contact anyone with a brown-sounding name, which shows where they're coming from, really. But yeah, it really does take it out of you. But thanks to friends, thanks to supporters, thanks to people like yourselves who've gone through what you guys have gone through, you know, that energy helps to stand up and fight the fight, which we have to do collectively.
Well, you know, the old maxim, unity is strength, is absolutely apposite here and is so important. And I know from personal experience how crucial that is, actually, that kind of solidarity from, grassroots supporters. So I can certainly relate to that. And I'm pleased that you felt that was something that helped you through what must have been an absolutely appalling ordeal. But, David, I mean, what do you make of the committee's judgment then that, they said that they could discern no reasonable or persuasive connection between Zionists and Grenfell, that the Jewish Chronicle headline highlighted there, and thus the remark must be anti-Semitic?
Well, I mean, first of all, the idea that a committee can decide whether something is anti-Semitic on the basis that they can't see what the connection with the Zionist movement is completely absurd. They need to get out a bit more and to do some more research. But, of course, what are the connections between Grenfell and the Zionists? One, that ministers in the government are all Zionists, the Conservative Friends of Israel, they're all members of that organisation. But more importantly, Arconic, which is the company which provided the cladding, its top shareholder is an organisation called Elliott Management, run by a guy called Paul Singer. He's the top donor to the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. One connection. Two connections. Sure. Arconic is an organization which is a construction company, which also is engaged in constructing F-35 fighters, which are being sent to Israel to bomb Palestinian children. Mm. Two connections. It's not my fault. It's not anybody else's fault that they can't perceive this. But there is a connection between Grenfell and the Zionists. And we can point this out with many, many other examples. So, and we should not be scared of saying that. It's not anti-Semitic to say it. There are connections between the Zionists and all sorts of appalling things which go on in the UK, including Grenfell.
Mm-hmm. One thing about the Zionists, they never let the facts get in the way of a good old-fashioned smear, do they?
Well, that's right. I mean, as everyone has now been saying, they lie and they lie and they lie, and that's the way.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Nazim, as far as I'm aware, there's been absolutely no media coverage of your historic win. I mean, why is that, do you think?
Well, it's almost, they've got custard pie in their face, haven't they? 7 years. 7 years of chasing me left, right and centre, going through the courts of various bodies, seven different organisations you mentioned. They've got nothing to show for it at the end, apart from what was determined back in, 2020, a warning. So it's been, like I said, a waste of taxpayers' money, a waste of time. It's shown how vindictive they've been towards me. Like I said, financially it's been a big burden on me. Emotionally, health-wise, it has been as well. And it just shows the nastiness of them, of the Zionist movement, how vindictive, nasty, and pretty much evil they are, that they just used everything they could that actually didn't affect them financially. As David made a great point there, they got people to interfight on their behalf, which is amazing. But who wants to admit failure? And that's what they would have to do, admit failure, because they were all gung-ho about, we're going to get him struck off, we're going to get him struck off.
Yeah, no, indeed. I mean, you're through it now, thank goodness, and, you've prevailed. And thankfully, as we were saying, you've got that grassroots support and solidarity to help you through what must have been a terrible ordeal, and you've won. And I think everybody will be, all right-thinking people anyway, will be absolutely delighted that you have got through it, and you've got through it, relatively unscathed, notwithstanding what you've already said, but you're here and you stand victorious. So, congratulations again on that, Nazim. But unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. So thanks for watching, and thank you to our guest, Nazim Ali, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Remember, you can follow the show on Facebook, Twitter and Telegram, where we post regular clips and updates. You can also help us to counteract the disinformation peddled by the corporate media about Palestine and the resistance to the Zionist entity by sharing today's programme on your social media platforms. So until next time, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more forensic investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight. In Britain, only 24% of people in England, Scotland and Wales are content with the National Health Service. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The independent television network ITV has covered this story and tells us more. Poor access to general practitioners and long waits for hospital treatment have led to public dissatisfaction with their National Health Service. The public satisfaction with NHS has now hit its lowest level on record. Fewer than 1 in 4 people, or 24%, were satisfied with the health service in 2023. Down 5 percentage points on the previous year, and the lowest level since records began in 1983, according to findings from the British Social Attitudes Opinion Poll. The study of 3,374 people in England, Wales and Scotland is seen as the gold standard test of how people feel about the National Health Service, the NHS.
while satisfaction with the NHS peaked in 2010, when 70% of people were satisfied with the health service, it has fallen since. And since 2020, satisfaction has fallen by 29 percentage points. However, support for the founding principles of the National Health Service remains high, with 91% believing the National Health Service should be free of charge when people need to use it, 82% agreeing it should be primarily funded through taxes, and 82% saying the National Health Service should be available to everyone. Findings from the opinion poll showed 52% of people were dissatisfied with the National Health Service, the highest proportion since the survey began. The main reasons for dissatisfaction are waiting times for GP and hospital appointments, 71%, followed by staff shortages, 54%.